Namaste. Well, it's been 24 hours. You might be pulsating with gratitude for being here. You might be filled with wondrous insights into the nature of reality, or you might be kind of like me on the first day of retreat, where I tend to think, I'm paying money for this? I could be a Club Med instead of a Club Meditation. Oftentimes when I get on retreat, I really think that the fantasy of how I thought it was going to be falls so short of what the experience actually is. And I also find oftentimes when I head into a long retreat, it's hard to get excited because I know that inevitably there are challenges. It's kind of like when Tara says to me, we need to talk. I know it'll be good for me. I know I'll be grateful I did it. But I'm not rushing into the experience necessarily. It's getting warm in here. But we all have some idealism when it comes to practice. You know, there's this promise that we read about and that we actually sense of what it's like to be free from suffering. We sense the possibility of spaciousness and ease and our capacity for happiness increasing. I always get caught by that Deepak Chopra line of feeling the infinite field of possibility. You know, it sounds so good. It's really attractive. And when we meditate, we hit the hard stuff. We hit the challenges. And that's what I'd like to talk about tonight. There are lots of different kinds of Dharma talks. There are talks on themes. There are talks on certain topics. And then there are kind of what I call the list talks. You know, there are lots of lists in Buddhist philosophy. The Four Noble Truths, the Three Characteristics of Reality, the Seven Factors of Awakening, on and on. And this is a list talk. I'd like to talk about one list primarily. Tonight's talk is about looking at what happens when we find ourselves caught and pulled away from the present moment. This talk is about the five hindrances, or the five obstacles, the classic ways that we react when we're not aware, or the five classic ways we react when things aren't going the way we want them to. This is fundamental stuff, and I imagine that many of you have heard this talk before. And so I thought I might offer just a few words on how to listen to a Dharma talk, particularly for those who might be new. Sometimes I find it helpful to take notes when I listen to a Dharma talk to kind of track the theme. It kind of engages my mind. Sometimes it's helpful just to kind of listen to the body, to sense what resonates for you. Another way to listen to a Dharma talk is to let it be part of your practice, to just be centered in the body, to let the words just kind of wash over you, and just to sense what feels right, what's a match for you. Oftentimes, it's helpful to remember that in a Dharma talk, we're not really learning anything new. It's really kind of a reminder of what we already know. So this is an important topic, I find, and a timely topic, and one that every time I reflect on the five hindrances, there's always a sense of the possibility of being able to recognize what's really going on, and a real sense of how close a sense of freedom can be, the possibility of that. Whenever we sit down and we pay attention, we get to see what interests the mind. And the mind is sometimes not interested in what you are interested in. You might have noticed that your mind is not so interested in your breathing. Even though that's your intention, perhaps, to really feel and be with the breath, the mind kind of goes off in other directions. Maybe I'm alone in that, but. So how do we bring these into harmony? And part of the practice is to be interested in what your mind is interested in. That's part of the investigative quality of Vipassana meditation or insight meditation. More than just being aware of what's happening as it's happening, you're exploring your relationship to what's happening, how you're holding it, your attitude toward your experience. Have you noticed today that some of your thoughts and stories are beginning to repeat themselves? As you go on, you may be able to actually identify your top 10. Just the kind of the grooves you fall into, the repetitive stories. And you might notice that you might have a particular tendency toward worry, or a tendency toward wanting or desire. Maybe part of your top 10 is noticing how your mind gravitates toward judgment, judging others or judging yourselves. Or maybe getting kind of lost in confusion or doubt or finding yourself getting into a place where you just want to give up, you just want to collapse. We kind of fall into these grooves. I kind of think of memories and sensations. They're kind of like microchips. They're kind of sending out the same message. And we get identified with that memory, and then we go into pretty predictable ways of reacting. Have you noticed how some people are outrage waiting to happen? And some people are rejection waiting to happen? Or sort of depression waiting to happen. And what we can do on retreat is to look closely at these patterns, at what keeps those cycles going on. So we'll talk about these five kind of mental interests that get in the way of what we most want, the primary obstacles between you and a calm mind. The Pali definition of the word hindrance is cover. It actually covers something. It's a very interesting concept to me. That under any experience, when you're experiencing anger, for example, it's a cover to something else. And when we can turn our attention directly to that experience, we can begin to look toward the root of that experience. Oftentimes, a lot of people on retreat will say, I just can't concentrate. These hindrances are what gets in the way of paying attention. So I'd like to review these mind states, but first I'd like to talk about kind of a fundamental approach that you'll be hearing again and again through the course of the retreat. A great teacher once said, if you want to understand the mind, then sit down and observe the mind. A good friend of mine back when I lived in the ashram was telling me how before he moved into the ashram, he worked in the finance industry and he hated his life. He was just miserable. So he went to a therapist who was also a meditator. He kind of unloaded his story, and the therapist said, you should really learn how to meditate. You'll feel better. So he kind of got excited, and he kind of got trained in meditation. He went off to a retreat, and the entire retreat was just filled with waves of anger and sadness and regret. And he went back to his therapist at the end of this retreat, and he said, what in the heck were you talking about? You told me that if I meditate, I feel better. But all I'm feeling is anger and sadness and regret. And the therapist smiled and said, yeah, you feel anger better, you feel sadness better, you feel regret better. And that's what happens. We feel better on retreat. when we start to observe the mind, we notice how it naturally wanders from our point of concentration. And when we encounter stress or suffering or pain, the mind moves in ways that we can begin to identify. We can actually study, become experts in the way the mind moves, and we can cultivate a greater sense of understanding and even a greater sense of compassion for ourselves and even for others when we begin to recognize these patterns. But before we dive into these, I wanted to just to cover another list briefly, because I think it can be a helpful roadmap. And these are referred to as the four foundations of mindfulness. The first foundation is the experience of sensations, just undifferentiated energy. It's just the experience of the aliveness, the vibrancy of sensation. The second foundation is how we find these incoming sensations falling into three fundamental categories. There are sensations that we find pleasant. There are sensations that we find unpleasant. And there are sensations that we find neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It's kind of a neutral quality. The third foundation is what emerges out of this felt sense of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, the thoughts and the stories and the emotions that proliferate from that experience. The fourth foundation kind of refers to the mental states and the patterns into which these thoughts and emotions fall, sort of the recognition of what are called the dhammas, the recognition of what's true in all of this. So why do we care about these four foundations? I find they can be kind of a helpful roadmap as we settle into meditation. Our primary focus is on this first foundation. Again and again today, you've rediscovered yourself in the body. Just the pure, simple experience of being in the body. As you sit, you begin to perhaps notice kind of subtleties that you miss on a typical busy day in the world. And you come back again and again and again, even perhaps just in this moment. As you sense the breath right now, where do you feel it most predominant? As you open to the experience of listening, can you feel the vibration of sound? The sounds on the furthest edge of your awareness. When you sense inside, can you contact any subtle tingling or vibration or pulse? In this primary experience of sensation, there's no good or bad. There's just what's here. It's what we come back to again and again, as Pat was saying earlier, to really relax, to not just to draw your attention back, but to consciously relax and embrace what's here. We also can become more and more intimately present to our reaction to those sensations as we interpret them as pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. It can become a fascinating doorway or a portal to our experience to simply notice how we're relating to that direct experience of sensation. It's been described as a hedonic tone, this feeling. And you may notice when you really pay attention to it how quickly it can shift. How you'll experience something pleasant and automatically, just unconsciously want to move toward it, to hold on to it. Something very subtle, not even through the mind, just a sensation in the body arises that's unpleasant. You want to move away from it. The experience of boredom and restlessness often arises out of the kind of that neutral, there's really nothing happening experience. And then in the third foundation, we get to observe how our mind just throws out thoughts endlessly. And the more we settle down, the more we realize that the mind is just this thought-generating machine, that it secretes thoughts like organs secrete fluids. After a while, possibly you start believing that every single thought is true. Over time, after a while of watching this parade of thoughts, it might become possible to disconnect yourself a little bit from the thoughts. You realize they come and they go. In this fourth foundation, we begin to recognize patterns. We start to see into the nature of what's really happening. We begin to see into the Four Noble Truths, how suffering is part of this experience. We begin to recognize that whatever we're holding on to is going to have some quality of stress or unpleasantness. We begin to recognize that when we can let go of something, there's a little bit of space, a little bit of opening possible. We begin to recognize that there are practices and technologies that support us in this process of letting go. And in that experience, we can begin to ask ourselves what this awareness is. What is this awareness, which is observing this arising of sensation and felt sense and thought? But let's look a little bit closer at how we can investigate our experience of what's happening. I understand that there's a story about apparently the Buddha had a bad back. And whenever anyone would ask the Buddha a question, he would turn his whole body to the questioner. I have no idea if that's true or not, but I found that metaphor very, very helpful, that when something arises in my meditation practice, if I can turn all of my awareness to it, it becomes a very powerful encounter to turn all of my awareness to what's arising. So there's an acronym, which you very well may have heard. The acronym is RAIN, R-A-I-N. And it becomes a very helpful formula sometimes. It's really kind of an equation. The R stands for recognizing or realizing what's happening. A very powerful experience to be able to name what's present. In many traditions, there's the practice of noting or labeling, where you actually consciously give a name to what's arising. And in that naming, there can be a very subtle or not so subtle shift in identification. In the shamanic traditions, they say if you can name a fear, you take its power away. You begin to sever your identification with it. So if aversion or ill will is arising, if you can name it, suddenly there's a shift from being identified with it as opposed to the possibility of being with it, being a witness to it. The A stands for allowing or accepting. To ask yourself, can I be with this experience? Can I allow this experience? And there are a few important parts of this question that I think are always helpful to remember. That when you can consciously ask that question, can I allow this? It's very important to recognize that if it doesn't feel safe, to really honor that. When we are doing an intensive practice, as we are in this week, oftentimes there can be memories that can be very troubling. And there can be old traumas that naturally kind of find their way to the surface. And if it doesn't feel safe, it can be enormously skillful to shift your attention in some way. So maybe to open your eyes, or maybe even to get up and get a cup of tea or go for a walk. But if you get a sense that you can actually allow, that you can, if you can be with, if you can meet your experience, that question alone can sometimes begin to shift your relationship to it. It's a little bit of an internal jujitsu. instead of fighting it, you're actually drawing it closer. And something happens internally. The I in this acronym is the invitation to be intimate with your experience, to actively investigate what's there. And this is extremely counterintuitive. A classic teaching story, a yogini is meditating in her cave and she's visited by three demons. These three demons are whirling around the cave. And she very calmly gets up and starts building a fire. And she's so non-reactive that these three demons get really irritated. So they crank it up. Horrible sounds and images and terrible stuff. Very quietly, very calmly, she puts a little tea kettle over the fire. And this enrages the demons. She's so non-reactive. So they throw everything they've got at her. The most horrible stuff you can imagine. And very calmly, very quietly, she puts these teacups out on this little table. And finally, the demons give up. They say, "What is going on? We are your three deepest wounds, your three worst nightmares. And here you are building this little fire, putting on this tea kettle, putting out these cups. What gives?" And she says, "Well, you've been here before. You'll be here again. So in the meantime, what kind of tea would you like to have?" And to me, that is the essence of the practice. When we encounter these hindrances, when we encounter these obstacles, is it possible to make tea for that experience? Is it possible to be intimate with it? In the intimacy, in the investigation, we can come back to these four foundations to really explore, what does it feel like inside? What is this experience of aversion? What is this feeling of sense desire? What does this feeling of crippling doubt feel like inside? Can you be with it? What arises when you be with it? You can also investigate it on the level of thought. What am I believing right now? What story am I believing now? Is it true? When we practice recognizing, realizing what's going on, allowing and accepting, investigating, being intimate with it, it can lead us to the end part of this equation, which can be a sense of non-identification. I kind of like to add some other nons onto it. A sense of non-judging, of non-grasping, a sense of natural awareness. Very easy to say in this formula, not so easy to practice when we are in the grip of something that feels so real and potent in the moment. These two elemental questions: what's happening right now, and can I be with it, are really kind of the DNA of investigating your experience. So let's take a look at these mind states. The first two categories fall into desire and aversion, into wanting and not wanting, into greed and hatred. So just a little bit from my experience with desire and wanting, I did a month-long retreat at Spirit Rock. And I'm mostly vegetarian, but I definitely eat some animal protein from time to time because it seems to work well for my body. And on this long retreat, it was a lot of beans and rice. Now, one of the things about Spirit Rock that's so beautiful is the campus is so peaceful that there are these wild turkey and deer kind of wandering through the property. On this retreat, Tara was one of the directors, and And she wrote me a really wonderful note. It said, "Can I get you anything?" And I wrote her back and I said, "Yes, a bow and arrow and a George Foreman grill." I found myself just fantasizing about my first meal at the end of the retreat. And I couldn't get my mind off how great it would be to have this wonderful meal. And again, my mind would sort of move to what I was going to have, a dark beer or a light beer, et cetera, et cetera. So at the end of the retreat, we went out for this meal, and the meal just didn't meet my fantasy. It really fell short of my fantasy. And have you noticed this in your life? How there's so much fantasy about what you're going to get, and when you have the experience, it doesn't quite match with what you wanted. Oftentimes we find ourselves caught in this quality of wanting, this sense of grasping. If you can just imagine, even now there's just something right there and you're just trying to reach it but you can't quite grasp it. There's so much tension in that wanting, yearning quality of mind. And so as we sit still, some of our ideas get very captivating. Oftentimes they come with some form of fantasy. And they're usually pleasant. Have you ever had that experience where you're meditating and you realize you sort of wake up in some fantasy? And then you make the decision just to go with the fantasy. When we encounter desire, we also encounter something about the promise of that desire fulfilled that sort of feeds the fantasizing mind. There's that allure of what could be out there. And we don't see the cost if we stay fixated on what it is that we want. And what drives desire is the fantasy of that desire fulfilled. If I get this, then I'll get this. Or if I get this, then this won't happen. If I get into that relationship, then I won't feel lonely. If I can get this project done, then I won't feel so empty. One of my teachers would often talk about how in life, so many people go through a process of, if I could only get into this relationship, then I'd be happy. And then later it's, if only we could get married, then I'd be happy. And then, if we could only have kids, then I'd be happy. And then, if only I could make it till the kids are out of the house, then I'll be happy. And then, if I could just get out of this relationship, then I'd be happy. If you stay in the desire, you don't get to the roots of the desire. And this practice is all about the roots. So one way to look at it is with compassionate presence. Rather than focusing on the object, you turn your attention 180 degrees to the subject, where the focus becomes the wanting itself. So when you recognize wanting, you can ask yourself, can I allow this state of wanting? What does it feel like inside to want? Can you feel the play of pleasant and unpleasant sensation? Can you identify some of the thoughts and stories that arise in that wanting? You don't have to stop the desiring, but you can turn your attention around and say, I see you. And chances are you won't be quite as pulled by your desires. When we're driven by our desires, wisdom is inaccessible. When we can be deeply present to our desires, it opens up some new possibilities as to how you're holding it. And so the opposite of desire takes us to the hindrance of ill will, of malice toward others or toward ourselves. And there are different flavors to this hindrance. It can show up as judgment. It can show up as contempt, as hatred. The revenge fantasies are part of this, of blame. Both wanting and non-wanting tend to fixate on a subject. At one of our retreats, there was someone who was sharing with me how much she hated the food. She was just appalled at our lack of care. And as she sat with it over days, she just felt this rage toward the teachers. How could they do this to me? In her head, she spent hours writing long letters as to what should be fixed and how it could be fixed. She resented the fact that she'd come all this way and was having this experience that didn't match. And she spent hours, she told me, scheming on how she was going to get all of her money back and maybe even a little bit more. And then she realized that she was having a hindrance attack. She realized she was utterly lost in her reactions. And then she went through that process of recognizing it, turning the attention from the object to the subject, to the experience of it, and realizing all the internal machinations around her aversion and her resentment. And it opened up some new possibilities. Some personality types are drawn toward desire, and others tend more toward aversion. And it's an interesting thing to note. If you tend to move toward fantasy and desire, or if you tend to, your mind tends a little bit more toward aversion or judgment. When we're caught in aversion, we can do tremendous harm. From the point of view of Buddhist practice, aversion can be helpful because it creates some impatience and can help you to kind of cut through a little more. I tend toward desire and fantasy myself, and I can spend kind of a scary amount of time sometimes, just sort of lost in pleasant thought. When you're more in aversion, it can be a little bit easier to sort of realize the unpleasantness of it and have that desire to kind of cut through. So how do you work with aversion? Once again, you turn your attention 180 degrees back. You explore what it feels like, even if it's you that you're feeling aversion toward. You focus on that as your subject. It can be very helpful in working with these hindrances to invoke compassion, if that's possible. There's a little phrase that can be helpful in this practice, because each of these hindrances has an uncomfortable quality. And the phrase is that we're trying to be comfortable with our discomfort. To try not to get so caught into reactivity, but to stay present to the discomfort itself. So these two winds of aversion and desire are themes that will run continuously through your retreat, and you may find that they get more and more subtle. So we'll look now at some of the other hindrances and their kind of energetic qualities. One is sloth and torpor. And you may have encountered some sloth and torpor today, perhaps. The whiplash meditation experience, where you're having that. It has to do with lethargy. And oftentimes it has to do with resistance. And I find there are two fundamental levels in the experience of that, of sloth and torpor and heaviness. One of them is simply biological. We live in an overstimulated, depleted culture. And you may find that you're simply needing downtime. You may be coming in contact very, very intimately into a recognition of how tired and how depleted you really are. And it's a healthy recognition. When you close your eyes with an intention to find your way back into balance, and the body really senses that intention, it will tell you what it needs, which may be lots of naps. So honoring that biological need for rest is very, very important. And to give yourself as much as you can time for very, very deep rest will be of immense benefit. There's another quality to sloth and torpor which has an emotional quality to it. It's not so much about the physical energy that's available, but about your inner attitude, about your inner strategy. And when you're caught in sloth and torpor, it's a little bit harder to turn that attention back 180 degrees because it's so easy to get pulled in deeper and deeper into the torpor. So there are a couple things that can be helpful on a physical level. If you find yourself having the whiplash meditation, you know, kind of nodding off, if you find yourself wanting to brush something off your shoulder and you find out it's the floor, it's a good sign that sloth and torpor has found its way into your experience. You might just try sitting a little straighter. You might see if you can bring in a little more mental alertness. You might turn your attention to sounds. It can be a way to kind of brighten your attention a little bit. You might open your eyes. Again, a little more stimulation can help. It's also a very wonderful thing from time to time to stand up at your seat. Sloth and torpor oftentimes feels like it's permanent. But if you can stay with it, it's like a weather system. It will shift and it will move through. When you investigate sloth and torpor and you sense there's some emotional quality, then it could be interesting here again to look at the roots of that experience. Oftentimes, sloth and torpor can be tied into the first two hindrances, some frustrated desire or some frustrated aversion. And again, sloth and torpor is an opportunity to practice compassion, to slow down, to sense if you can be kind to that experience. And again, to recognize, to sense if you can allow, to investigate your experience of where the resistance is. Sometimes what feels like sleepiness can actually be an indication of a shift in consciousness. As you shift into the deeper brainwave states of theta and delta, oftentimes what's associated in that experience can be a sense of temporal and spatial awareness being a little bit different. Your sense of time and space. And you may have had some moments in meditation where you feel very present, but at the same time your sense of time has just shifted a little bit. Have I been here 10 minutes or 30 minutes? Or you might feel, again, very present to the breath or sensations, and your body may feel very light or maybe very heavy. You might feel the arms heavy. It can be an indication of a brainwave shift that can feel like sleepiness. So if you begin to feel that sleepiness, if you have the awareness, just to sharpen your attention a little bit, you may be able to stabilize your attention in a very, very profound state sometimes. So the opposite of sloth and torpor, of that heaviness and lethargy, is restlessness. Restlessness and agitation is having lots of energy. When the going gets tough, some people shut down. Maybe you notice how sometimes, you know, little babies, when there's a lot of stimulation, they just sort of shut down. The nervous system just needs to close down for a little bit. And when the going gets tough, some people get hyped up. They sense that I have to do something about this. Sometimes I find that restlessness and agitation can be tied into remorse. Some regret over something in the past that can be very, very stimulating. Once in a retreat, I had a memory from many, many years back. I grew up on a farm, and it was my responsibility to feed the sheep. And I had this full-scale memory of a time when it was in the winter and we had our ewes with their babies. They were kind of in a separate part of the barn. And it was my job to water them. And I just spaced out one day. And then I remembered, and I ran out to the barn, and I remember these ewes who had their babies were really, really thirsty. And as I poured water in, they just drank it all down, and I got more and they drank it down, and the suffering of that experience was so painful for me. Just such a deep sense of guilt and regret. And there was a restlessness about that. I could not get my mind to settle. And it took me a long, long time to work with that feeling inside, to work with the kind of the thoughts and the guilt and so forth. And for me, again, part of that practice was coming back to rain, just to recognizing what was there, all the different flavors of guilt and shame and regret, a sense that I couldn't do anything about it, to continually open to it, to feel it. And over time, there was a sense of forgiveness. And with that sense of forgiveness, a really deep intention to do no harm. And over time, as I was with that agitation, some calm began to emerge. Sometimes when you feel yourself caught in restless and agitation, it can be kind of interesting to watch because there's so much energy. And one teacher described it as like ping pong balls just sort of bouncing around inside, watching the churning, watching the tightening. Oftentimes when we find ourselves caught in agitation and restlessness, a common root is worry or fear. How do we stay present to these uncomfortable experiences when they arise? We can find ourselves just pushed and pulled by these memories. There's a question that I find helpful for myself when I am caught in one of these hindrances, whether it be desire or aversion, sloth and torpor, with restlessness and doubt, which we'll talk about next. When I can recognize it, if I find it within my capability to actually allow it or accept it, question I find helpful is to ask, how does this want me to be with it? How does this restlessness want me to be with it right now? And I find that question, it sets up a deeper sense of intimacy with it. It's part of that turning all of my attention to it. The fifth mind state that we can find ourselves caught in has to do with doubt. And doubt is considered one of the most dangerous hindrances. because this is the hindrance that can take us away from practice. We doubt ourselves. We doubt the teachings. We doubt the teachers. Being caught in that, just that belief that I can't do this. I just can't do this. When we're caught in doubt, it can lead to indecisiveness. It can lead to a sense of paralysis. Have you ever spent weeks making a decision that could have been made in 2 minutes? So again, with doubt, is it possible to shift your attention from the object, from the story, to the subject, to the experience of doubt? When you recognize that you are entranced by doubt, once you can name it, can you accept it? Can you allow it? Can you investigate it? Tied into doubt is the sense of the ruthless critic. That voice that's there with that constant criticism. Not enough. Sometimes it can be helpful in the experience of doubt when you can feel the paralysis that's part of it, is to ask yourself, what benefit am I getting out of being doubtful? What would I have to feel if I didn't feel doubt? Sometimes doubt helps to keep us from feeling things, from making a decision, from having clarity. Doubt has a very healthy side, a quality of discernment when you're not trusting what's there. So doubt is not necessarily a negative thing. The third Zen patriarch has some really beautiful teachings about working with doubt that I have found tremendously helpful. He described it as cultivating two things. First is having an intellectual understanding. An intellectual understanding of the process of transformation. To remember when you're caught in doubt over the course of this week, for example. To realize that with any of these hindrances, this is part of the process. This is part of the transformational journey. With an intention to know who you are without fear, without anxiety. Everything that is not fully digested in your life will find its way to your experience. When we can remember that intellectually, it can be very helpful. This is part of the process. Each one of these hindrances, each one of these weather systems, whenever you're caught in any one of these hindrances, they can feel permanent. The blind rage, that sense of lust and desire, the mind that will not calm, that will not settle. The sloth and torpor that feels like you're just being drawn down into a sleepy swamp forever and ever. The criticism that feels like it won't release itself. Recognizing this is part of the journey, part of the process. So cultivating intellectual understanding is very, very helpful. The third Zen patriarch went on to talk about what he called cultivating the faith mind. And this leads us to the whole question of refuge. What is it that you hold which is greater than your mind? When you release that which you're holding on to, what are you releasing it into? And who led us into an investigation of the refuges, taking a refuge in awareness, just awareness itself, taking refuge in what is true and what is here, and taking refuge in love, compassion for yourself. Oftentimes I find, particularly one of the great advantages of being on retreat is just drawing on the group energy to stay present. That ineffable energy that we are holding here together, the intention that we're holding here together. At some point in our practice, we can begin to turn our attention to awareness itself. We can ask ourselves, who is it that is noticing this weather system? What is it that's aware of what has this grip or what is releasing right now? These winds are constantly pulling and pushing, ill will, wanting, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, doubt and criticism. The more you settle into your experience, the more you may begin to recognize, are there patterns? Do you more easily move toward one or the other? Do you more easily get angry or frustrated? Do you find yourself consistently lost in fantasy? Are you working with agitation? Do you find yourself paralyzed in doubt or find this critic, this unrelenting self-critic, as something that feels inescapable at times? One of my favorite teachers recommended to his students to become experts in the hindrances, to become specialists. And it's a very helpful thing to be able to recognize the hindrance of the moment. As soon as you can name it, you begin to shift your relationship to it. If it's possible for you to allow it or accept it, you're shifting your relationship to it. When you can turn your attention 180 degrees between that which is between you and feeling free, new possibilities will begin to emerge. When I was about 14, I was on a canoeing trip with my family. We were out for 12 days in the National Boundary Waters canoe area, in Minnesota and Canada. And we were about 4 days into the trip, and it rained for 3 days solid. And our canvas tents were wet. Our sleeping bags were wet. The wood was wet. My clothes were wet. And you know what it's like when it's cold and rainy and you're wearing jeans and they're wet? I looked at my father and I said, if I had an anvil, I would tie it around my neck and I would throw it in that lake. My father had been in World War II, wounded 3 times, missing in action. He gave me a look I'd never seen before. And he just looked me in the eye and he said, hey, no one's shooting at us. And that shifted my awareness in a big way. Suddenly it wasn't quite as cold and wet. So there's an interesting little teaching from the Buddha that I'd like to read. How does one live contemplating the mental objects of the 5 hindrances? When anger is present, know there is anger in me. Or when anger is not present, know there is no anger in me. Know how the arising of the non-arisen anger comes to be. Know how the abandoning of the unrisen anger comes to be. How can we cultivate a state of awareness that is aware when the hindrances are not present? Just as to know that no one is shooting at you, to know that this moment is free of doubt, this moment is free of agitation, this moment is free of desire, free of aversion. This is not just an intellectual place of understanding, but an internal state where we can be profoundly aware We're not trying to alter, change, or manipulate our experience, but you're simply present and aware. So learning how to recognize these hindrances is really a major key in learning how to cultivate a greater sense of freedom. It's very important to recognize that the experience of the hindrances is not a personal failing. For many years, I thought that meditation was all about trying to avoid the hindrances, trying to avoid these five mental states. And far from it, I've really come to realize that when they arise, there is an opportunity for freedom. So look for hindrance attacks. A meditation retreat is a great place to experience multiple hindrance attacks, to recognize them when they come, to sense if you can have tea with them when they arise, to sense if you can allow the unpleasantness of these states to be, if you can actually be intimate with it, to really feel where you sense it in the body, to sense the stories, the beliefs that are associated, to sense if you can hold it in a quality of loving presence. Wisdom comes from familiarity. Your hindrances will come with regularity over the course of this retreat. And as you get to know them, as you get more and more familiar with them and use them as an object of study, you will cultivate a greater sense of wisdom and a greater sense of compassion. You'll recognize that everyone at some point feels what you feel. You'll feel confidence growing, that you can be with anything that arises. And you'll recognize that anything can be healed by paying attention to it, by being present for it, by holding it with compassion. Wonderful quote. Here lies before the meditator's feet, like the serpent's worn-out skin, a lifeless heap of thin and wrinkled thought tissue. Once it had seemed so full of alluring beauty, this proud and deceptive idea of I and mine. Each of these hindrances, when they come, they feel so real, they feel so alive. We're so identified with them. The more we can be with them, investigate them, have tea with them, that sense of I and mine can begin to fall away. So I'd like to close with a little reflection in just a few readings. If you like, you can close your eyes. As you sense the breath, you might like to reflect on who you are in the absence of desire, who you are in the absence of aversion. You're sensing, intuiting who you are in the absence of sloth and torpor, in the absence of agitation, restlessness, and doubt. Perhaps all of this talk is summarized in the following sutra. Abandon all these attitudes of wanting to prolong pleasure and avoid suffering. Let the heart be itself and feel whatever is there. Freed from clinging and avoiding, the heart regains its poise and revels in creation. Plunging deep into its center, discover that the heart is moved by a pulse that is everywhere. In the absence of clinging and avoiding, the heart regains its poise and revels in creation. Plunging deep into its center, discover that the heart is moved by a pulse that is everywhere. Namaste.